This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I am not in Soys Bay. I am not in Dunedin. I am in Hyderabad in India. I'm at a conference called CompEd, which is bringing computer science education research to the global south. And I am with John Chapman, who is not from here. He is from Leesburg, Virginia. Welcome, John.
Yes.
Where did you grow up?
Grew up in the South in the United States. So Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia. I was born in Florida. Yep.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I looked at an old book and it was all the typical fireman, policeman. It was just funny. I actually was cleaning out my garage and I looked at this, what I had written, and and I'm not a fireman or a policeman by any stretch, and I wouldn't want to be either. They have tough jobs.
So what did you do?
I ended up becoming a math major in college, and that kind of gave me a lot of flexibility to do a lot of different things that were STEM related. And I got my MBA, and when I was in college, I really liked to build things and start things. So when I was in college, my brother and I patented and invented a mouse cleaner, and we went to the first Macworld convention. And then he and I later on started our own internet company, and we ended up taking it public. It was crazy. And it was all during those crazy times around 2000. And about 10 years ago, I was 49 years old, and I said, what do I want to do for the last 20 years of my life? And my wife had me, she suggested I volunteer in a local high school to teach computer science and to help the teacher teach computer science. And I got hooked, loved the kids, loved the subject. And there's a huge need. So I ended up teaching math and computer science, and that's what I've been doing the last 10 years. And I worked on my PhD about 4 years ago in curriculum instruction with integrative STEM.
So talking about crazy mouse cleaning, when you said mouse cleaning, I did imagine a little mouse standing there.
No, that was back in the old days where you had the two, they were actual physical. There was a physical ball in your mouse, and there was a roller for the x-axis and a roller for the y-axis, and the ball that moved those, it would get gummed up and then it would start sticking. So we created this ball with the Velcro on it. You take the rubber ball out that was in the mouse, you put the Velcro in, you run it on the pad, it would spin and scrub at the same time. It's kind of cool. Yeah.
So you... What did you fell in love with teaching, or you were inspired by teaching? What it was kind of by accident you got there, but what kept you there?
So I started. It was funny. I started in the classroom just as a volunteer, and I was working at the same time. The teacher at the time, he only lectured once and gave the students a packet and said, you know, basically kind of do the labs on your own. And I just couldn't believe that was the state of computer science education. I'm like, I loved interacting with the kids. That was, I just really enjoyed that piece. And there was one time when I went away for work for about a week, and I came back and I said, all right, where, what lab are you guys on? What are you guys doing? And they're like, we're at the same spot we were last week. And I'm like, oh. So then I just, at that point in time, I decided, and I kept coming home. I kept coming home and talking to my wife, and I'd be like, oh, and I'd be talking and talking and talking, and I'd be like, you know, I really love teaching. She's like, do it. I'm like, what do you mean do it? She goes, teach. And then, so they have these career switcher programs. I joined one, and the next May, I'd gotten a job as just a regular high school teacher.
And that's what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I teach at a magnet school. I was actually really lucky. I had been teaching for 2 years at a regular public school, and they were opening up a magnet school, and they were going to start Academy of Engineering and Technology, and they were going to start it off in the basement, and they were looking for teachers to help kick it off just for the very first freshman class. I applied for the job. I don't even know if any other computer science teachers even applied for the job. So then not only did I get the job, but then I was able to basically design the curriculum as well and then create the curriculum. And for me, that was, I couldn't believe the opportunity that I had.
What's a magnet school?
So a magnet school is, in my county, you have to apply to get in and you have to take a test. And they generally take the top 10% of students in the county. You also have to apply to a type of school and say why you want to go there. There's three different schools. One's like a trade school. In my school, there's three sub-schools, if you will. So there's an Academy of Science, there's Academy of Engineering and Technology, and there's MATA, which is more like a trade school.
And you have the full range of high school?
Yeah, so it's really weird how we do it. They actually go, that's a good question. They actually have a home high school they go to. So they go there for English and social studies. But all of their STEM classes, they go to the academy. Academies have allowed them, yeah.
Are they shifting like every day? Or
every other day we have them. So they go to their home school. It's called A-day, B-day schedule. So on A-days, they'll go come to the academy. Allows them. On B-days, they stay at their home school. Yeah. And their home school is just like a regular high school.
There's too many days in the week to do that. Or does it cycle around?
Yeah, it's just A-day, B-day, A-day, B-day. Okay. So sometimes it's 3 days a week I have them, sometimes it's 2 days a week.
And how far are you trying to get them in terms of the development of their computing skills?
Yeah, so from a computer science perspective, we're really lucky because I'm a computer science pathway leader. And so we actually have them for 4 years, and we know the STEM classes they're going to take. So they take CS1 as freshmen. They take APCS, which is... I don't know for your listeners if they're familiar with the APCS. They get college credit for the course. If they get a 4 or 5 on the APCS exam at the end of the year, then they actually get credit for like CS1 college. So they're taking that sophomore year. And then junior year, we created this course on machine learning where they're actually designing and coding the engines. So they'll actually write linear regression, logistic regression code. They'll do back propagation by hand. And then the second semester, that's for the first semester. And we're going to turn that into a full year course because we need more time to teach them that. And then the second semester is app development using React Native. And then the senior year, they do a capstone course. So hopefully we've prepared them to go solve a problem or build some software. Now that you have some skill set, go actually do something and build something.
I was going to ask that. So why are the kids taking it? What's led them to computing?
Yeah, right? Because they have to kind of make that decision as eighth graders. Mm-hmm. So for some of the kids, they've known they've always loved computing. And for some of the kids, it's because their parents said, you need to do this because you can make a lot of money. So we definitely get some students that, not a lot, but we definitely get some students that aren't there because they want to be there. They're there because their parents made them go there. So we have to, we have to focus on engagement, and they don't have a choice. It's really hard to opt out So they get a chance kind of to opt out after 2 years, but they kind of have to be in it for 2 years and then they can choose to leave. So it's a commitment.
I suspect the answer to this is a bit of both, but do you engage them through the abstract challenge or through the project, you're doing something.
Yeah, right. So I think the way it kind of works is the first year we do more fun. We do graphics and we teach them some of the basics, but it's more fun, less stressful. Second year is, that's the APCS year, and that's more, okay, you're going to get skills. So we're going to make sure you're writing good, clean code. We're going to make sure you know how to write recursive routines, do data structures, and they get a really good, solid foundation. And then the third year is, okay, now that you have a solid foundation, let's do machine learning. And because they have that solid foundation, like they basically, we spend 2 weeks learning Python. They just kind of learn it because they know programming is just a new, it's just a new language. And the great thing about machine learning is it's fun. I mean, you've got some neat data sets that you can work with, powerful programming. Some of the kids don't like all the math with it, but then the second semester we're doing app development with React Native. So then they, you know, the kids that hate the machine learning like the app development.
Let's take the first of your music choices. Let's have Yo-Yo Ma, Cello Suites. Why this one?
So I love Bach. One of the reasons why I love Bach, I love it. You know, I was just starting to listen to the music this last go around. He's very mathematical in terms of how he writes. And I love, Yo-Yo Ma has his latest album. He actually introduces each one of the suites and talks about it. And one of the things he talks about is how Bach structures his suite, cello suites, and he talks about how he, one piece of the suite is the head, one piece is the heart, and one piece is the hands. And really, as a teacher, right, we really want to connect with our students kind of, and in STEM, we always focus on the head, but the kids need the heart. And when I say the heart, I mean they need projects that they care about, they need projects that are interesting. Obviously, they're going to get the head part with the logic, and then the hands is, you know, then they have to actually build it. So they get to code it, and they get to see the results of their labors. The other reason why I like it is there's this book called Gödel Escher Bach that was written in the 90s. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But Gödel's incompleteness theorem, the way he proved his incompleteness theorem was Turing used his method of proving it as his basis for his Turing machine. And the book actually compares Bach's music to Escher's drawings to Gödel's incompleteness theorem. It is absolutely amazing, but by doing that too, Bach's tied to computer science, which is really cool. Thank you.
you will have graduated students in the last year who spent most of their high school years in some sort of lockdown.
Yeah.
How'd they do?
The ones that are doing well are the ones that were in high school during COVID. They kind of already had the independent study skills, and that was good. The ones we're seeing struggle right now are the juniors, and they were like 7th and 8th grade during COVID. And the ones who had parents at home that could help them was great. And the ones who didn't, they're really struggling. I mean, I think I've talked to multiple teachers, and they're all like, what is up with that? And it's, I think it's clear that those were critical formative years, and they were at home, and it's just, it was really tough. And so I think, you know, I think teachers around are helping them catch up, but it's taking years to help them catch up. So the ones who've just graduated, they're doing fine. Yeah. It's the juniors I'm worried about. Juniors and sophomores. And so the 17, 16, 17 year olds. Yeah.
Do you think that the experience that they've been through is going to affect them in terms of their careers, like where they might be wanting to, to go?
Right? Because, I mean, if they didn't get the math skills they needed, then that definitely limits what they could do. I had one student that struggled really a lot with computer science, and it was because of the math. He couldn't do the math, like literally couldn't do the math. And we got him through. He left the program after 2 years, but then we pushed him into networking and Cisco. He's doing great. Absolutely passing him with flying colors. Could he have been a good computer programmer? Absolutely. But I think the fact that he had those poor math skills pushed him into a direction, that, you know, that he's ending up in a great spot, but he's definitely limited to some degree.
You talked about how a bit of a focus is the machine learning. We've seen a lot of that in the last year or two. The AI has grown massively and improved probably an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with that for the high school teaching, and high school learning, more to the point?
In terms of what?
Well, firstly, there's the quotes, cheating aspect, but I think and I suspect you quite quickly move on past that. How are they using it?
That's really interesting right now. They don't allow them to use it in school. So the filters definitely filter it out. In my classrooms, I make them go up on the whiteboard and write their code on the whiteboard. So it's really hard for them to like turn in code that GPT-4 did. Sometimes they go into Replit though, and Replit has this they have this AI thing, and it starts completing it for them. So sometimes it completes it for them, and they don't understand the code. Sometimes it completes it for them incorrectly, and sometimes it just completes it for them correctly, and they don't learn anything. So, I mean, we're gonna have to, as teachers, we're gonna have to adapt, I do think, though, that it makes it very exciting. So when we're teaching machine learning, it's self-evident why it's important to learn it. And I think a lot of the students they want to understand how it works. Like, what's the magic behind it?
And for those people who are attracted by the Making a Difference, the project, AI lets you get further faster.
Yes, much further, much faster. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, wow, we can get this data set, and then we can analyze it, and maybe we can come up with, rather than just building an app or something like that, they can study something and try to answer a question or solve a problem. Diabetes research. I had one student that created, this was like 2 or 3 years ago, she had created this, this machine learning program where you could take pictures of your skin to see if it was cancerous or not. And she took a picture of her skin just to test it, and it came up as possibly cancerous. And so she went to the doctor, and they're like, oh my gosh, it is possibly cancerous. We need to remove it right now. So it was really powerful for her. Machine learning really opens up a lot of possibilities for applying computer science.
Where do you think it's going to head for teaching?
For teaching? For teaching computer science specifically or for teaching in general?
In general.
Wow.
I suspect your colleagues will be turning to you and saying, you know, I'm teaching social studies or history or something, and I can't tell if these essays are being written by...
Yeah. No, I'm actually looking at it from a different perspective, and I'm looking at it from now that these tools for machine learning and data science specifically are available for students, and you don't necessarily need to be like spend 4 years programming. You can probably get up to speed with some of these tools to analyze data. And we can introduce it in classrooms, like in social studies and in math and in, you know, non-STEM classrooms, to allow kids to tell stories with the data, to allow kids to visualize. I actually think it's going to be kind of a Trojan horse for computer science to get kids that wouldn't normally be interested in it. And I think we were talking about this morning during the keynote, but it's hard to introduce computer science in elementary school and middle school because teachers don't know programming, and because for a lot of the teachers, they have to remove a lesson to teach computer science, right? And now we're trying to add computational thinking skills to a social studies class, but it's much easier to say, hey, why don't we just add some data to whatever social studies lesson you're doing, and then we'll teach the kids how to visualize it, or teach the kids how to tell a story with it, and that's how they don't have to take out the lesson. We just machine learning, data science it, and incorporate that. So I think there's actually a huge opportunity for computer science in K-12, and I think it's going to be good.
Do they need to know that they're doing computer science? Can you?
Right.
You can
yes.
Trojan horse it.
Yeah.
But eventually, they might just be doing it without realizing it, but then wouldn't identify that as a career.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's going to be lots of careers where it's not computer science, right? It's going to be biology, but I use the computer as a tool to analyze the data or whatever to answer a question or solve a problem. And yeah, I absolutely, you know, it may get to the point where it's sort of like math, where math's not a career, right? Math's kind of a tool to help you answer questions and solve problems. And I think data science and the computers are probably going to go that direction too.
Do you sometimes find yourself in class running along to keep up?
Oh my God. Everything changes. It's driving with computer science, especially with AI. You know, 5 years ago, Andrew Ng's course, you know, was it. And, you know, you learn linear regression, you learn logistic regression, you taught basic neural networks with Keras. And then now they're not only just adding new models and new ways to do machine learning, large language models, but they're combining them, and they're combining them in new, unique ways. And it's even the professional researchers struggle to keep up. So I remember, from last year to this year, all my solution code stopped working because something was deprecated in NumPy. It's just like, all of a sudden, you know, I had to redo my solution code from 1 year to the next.
I heard somebody say that the art of teaching was to teach the kids to ask questions you didn't know the answers to. And I suspect you have to do quite a lot of...
Yeah. Yeah, and I think with machine learning and with data science specifically, is we're going to be able to start pushing those kids to do that kind of stuff, right? And I think as teachers... And I don't, you know, honestly, I really probably don't do a very good job as a teacher of that right now. But that's where things are going. And we're going to have to develop that ability as teachers to push kids to do those kind of things. Not just as a capstone project, but in the first year and in the second year. We're going to have to start incorporating it earlier on. Not like, oh, we're going to teach you the skills and teach you the basics. And then eventually you get to the point where you can... use the computer tool to ask questions that we don't know the answers to.
Does that change your identity as a teacher, that you're no longer the font hall knowledge, or the your job has changed into more of a inspiration?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, I think in computer science, and you've probably seen this as well, is it is changing so fast and it's so broad, you can't know everything. Professionals that have been doing it for 30 years don't know everything. They know they don't know everything. So I think it's kind of comes part and parcel with computer science. I think it's going to be harder maybe for some of the more traditional teachers, like a stats teacher. All of a sudden, you've got to incorporate data analytics. Well, I never took a data science course. I never took, you know, I don't know how to code NumPy and Python. I don't know how to use these tools. I've been teaching AP stats. AP is, you know, a college credit course that they can take in high school. I've been teaching it for 20 years. And so I think for some of the teachers, or calculus, for example, in high school, I think for some of those teachers who've been teaching it for 30 years, it's going to be hard for them. The science, the biology teacher, and all of a sudden you're going to say, hey, we're, you know, you need to incorporate some machine learning into it. It's going to be hard for them because they've been teaching the same biology course for 30 years. And some of them it's changed, but not like, it's going to be hard. I think it's less hard for a computer science teacher.
Do you teach with crossover? Can they do your projects on the biology course?
Yeah, and a lot of, yes, and a lot, we have the Academy of Science, and we've just started teaming up students, our CS students, with some biology students. There's not enough of that. So usually what happens is our CS students like biology, and they go, oh, I'd really like to do this biology analysis, or I'd really like to do whatever. Maybe they're, you know, interested in, you know, some kind of physics problem, and then they want to apply it in that direction. We need to do it. That data science is going to force that whole thing to happen. It will absolutely force it to happen.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ko tahua hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I speak to you all from my womansion in the glorious paradise, Otiporti's Dunedin, and the whole womansion is shaking and the Tawhiri Matea is prancing about outside, and the song of the wind is whistling through the womansion and the rain is falling and it's very dramatic. So I was hoping to host some rakatahi from Pukaraki Marae this afternoon, but that may not be possible if it is still bucketing down later today, so we shall see. And of course, this has got me thinking about how, even with the best laid plans and the best of intentions and everything that we possess to make things actualize as we have planned, life often intervenes and gives us new sets of circumstances, new plans, new opportunities to adapt and expand our previous perceptions of what was possible. And of course, we've all experienced this over the last several years, and indeed our whole lives, but in much starker contrast and in much more urgent circumstances over the last several years. So I do think it's important that we take our time to feel very proud, very pōhokereru, and feel our own power, our own strength, and our own love. And indeed tune into these great capacities that we have and reward ourselves in the best ways possible for all the hard work that we have been doing. And of course, not only ourselves, but those around us, both in human and other life forms. And for me at the moment, I'm just really enjoying 2024, as they say, 2024. And we had many gigs and shows over the new year time, and that was very, very enjoyable. And we had many people chanting 2024 and appreciating the power that we all possess, so that was very nice. And of course, when we find ourselves in times of turmoil and change, it is always good to remember that we are part of a much larger, much older ecosystem. And of course, the human world and all of the many things that we have created as part of the human world can at times try us and confuse us and beguile us, but the living world will not do that. And so there's always that place of comfort and sanctuary for us to return to, even when it's raining. There's the beautiful music to it. So, yes, I hope that for you all coming into this new year, you are enjoying seeing those myriad capacities and their beautiful flow and effects that you all possess, and going more deeply into what you want and need for yourself this year. And of course, this is an integral part of our role as living beings. It is our job, it is our responsibility to give ourselves what we need, which is wonderful adventure and pleasure, really. And for me, you know, this year I'm really wanting to go more into my understandings of embodying and bodily connection with our paradise planet and with one another and with myself. And I will be doing some yoga teacher training. Oh my goodness. And, oh yes, 100 hours. So wish me luck, Koto. I have full faith in myself, but it has been a long time since I have been inside from 7 a.m. till 5 p.m. So I will be relishing my outside breaks, but this is a learning for me. So I really hope for you, whatever's flying your way in 2024, you're feeling that you will, and you will, enjoy and triumph as always. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm talking with John Chapin. We're in Hyderabad. How's Hyderabad?
You know, I spent 6 weeks in Delhi. Hyderabad is up and coming. It's at least the part we're in, right? Cyberabad or whatever they call it. It's cleaner. It's definitely modern. It's much more modern than I anticipated. I thought it was going to be really hot, and it's, the weather's actually been really nice and gorgeous. So yeah, I've actually enjoyed Hyderabad, and the biryani is amazing.
What were you doing in New Delhi?
So my sons had, their third degree black belts, and they, and I have a friend of mine, Santosh, who had a, he had a school there for slum kids, and he asked us to help teach the slum kids. I asked my sons to help teach the slum kids self-defense. So we came in for 2 summers, for 3 weeks each summer, and taught slum kids self-defense. Super intense, super awesome. It was amazing.
Did you sneak some computing in?
You know, I did not. No, that is not, you know, they needed a lot of the more basic stuff, so it was kind of hard to sneak some of the computing in. So, no, we weren't able to do that.
And you're here now, at the start of, well, nearly the middle of December.
Yeah.
What's Christmas look like?
Christmas is just going to look like me at home with my family. My sons are 25 now, and they live like 15 miles away from us. So it's just going to be a nice, quiet. I get about a week and a half off. So it's going to be just a nice, quiet stay. Thank goodness, stay at home Christmas. And I'm going to be working on, although I am going to be working on expanding that machine learning course from a semester to a full year. So, yeah.
Well, you won't have a white Christmas because you're in the South.
We may have a white Christmas this year. No, we it's weird. Some years, like years, we got no snow, and then 1 year we got 36 inches of snow, which is, what is that? That's a meter of snow. We got a meter of snow in about 24 hours. So sometimes it dumps on us, and we get a lot of snow. I'm hoping for some snow days at school. So last 2 years we haven't gotten any snow, but we got a lot of snow that year. So yes, we may get a white Christmas. I'm hoping for it.
We've seen lots of change over the last few years. What do you think is going to stick? And perhaps more importantly, what do you hope will stick?
In terms of?
Anything you like.
I am really impressed and hopeful of the young generation. You know, I talk to some older people and they're like, oh, young people these days, blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's the typical older generation complaining about the younger generation, you know. But since I deal with them every day, absolutely amazed at how socially conscious they are, how they realize they have a responsibility to kind of fix a lot of the things that people in my generation have messed up between global warming, diversity, equity, and they're very aware. And I'm super hopeful that that sticks and they don't grow out of it. I think it will. You know, and even like, I'll give you an example, like my sons, one of my sons, they went to a business school, so they're very, in some ways they were taught to be very capitalistic, but one of my sons took a course on oceanography and he goes, dude, how much plastic is in the oceans? And he just, he was, you know, he understands that you can't just make money and not think about, and not think about the impact that you're having, you know. So, and I think most of the younger people are that way. And they understand that they can't have everything and that there are trade-offs. And they're willing to make a lot of those trade-offs. They're willing to not have everything just for themselves because they know that there's a price that other people may have to pay.
Have you had perhaps uncomfortable conversations with students about that and computing being buy more stuff?
No, and you know, yeah, with machine learning, right? Because one of the things they talk about with machine learning is AI, or no, it was the whole digital currency and the amount of electricity they use just to calculate, you know, the digital currency was like the whole country of Italy, right? To do the tokens, it was amazing. And yeah, so I don't think the students realize how much is being used to train these models. And at some point, you know, it's going to impact the amount of electricity that we use, right? And yeah, so it does, but I don't, you know, do I have the conversations? I don't know if we're really aware of how much the real impact is. People say, oh, it's expensive, but you know, how much, like, what is the negative impact on the environment?
We're pretty good at hiding that from ourselves. We turn the light on and the light comes on.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and in, traditionally in artificial intelligence, I have this huge book on artificial intelligence, literally called Artificial Intelligence. It's considered the Bible. And the number of pages on ethics is like 6, you know, because it's from 1995 and we didn't worry about bias in the data sets and didn't worry about all of that. And now I think it's becoming a much bigger thing. But, you know, I think as teachers and computer science teachers, we put our head in the sands and like say, oh, let's just focus on the algorithms and getting them to code. And, you know, I don't know if I have enough time in my schedule to put in a long ethics. We'll talk about it for one day and then we'll just move on. And I don't know if we really make it an integral part of the whole course. Maybe other people do. It's definitely something I need to improve on.
Is it in the curriculum that they come out with a critical view or ability to understand that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the curriculum's new for K-12, and I was actually on the working group for AI4K12.org, which was a National Science Foundation funded, came up with the 5 big ideas. I don't know if you saw it in she actually had a slide on it this morning, but we actually helped come up with those 5 big ideas, but that was only 2 years ago. And those are guidelines for curriculum writers. At the center, talks about ethics, and the centerpiece is ethics. So everything's supposed to be around ethics, but we really didn't, you know, until those 5 big ideas, they didn't Nobody really talked about it, but they did make it a core of that. So now I think you're starting to see that, but that was only 2 years ago. So,
do you think that is going to lead to a rethink around that, or can you bolt that on?
You can't really, you really shouldn't bolt it on, right? Because it's each piece of teaching machine learning, for example, specifically, whether it's data sets or like she was talking this morning, she was talking about auditing the, the machine learning model, which is on the tail end, right? All of, and when you create your model and choosing your model, you've got to consider ethics in all of that. You know, how opaque is your model? If you're going to give out loans, do you need to know how it's making decisions? You know, maybe you need to use linear regression instead of just throwing it into some neural network where you don't, it's a black box, you have no idea how it's making a decision. Whereas, you know, if it's deciding whether something's cancerous or not, that's an easy way to, you know, yeah, you can use neural networks. I don't know if I really need to know how it's making decisions. It just needs to make good ones. So, so you have the data coming in, you need to think about ethics. You have the model, you need to think about ethics. And then on the tail end, when you audit it, you need to think about ethics.
Can you successfully engage kids in things like the trolley problem through the self-driving car question?
Yeah, right? That would be things that we struggle with ethics-wise. And sometimes, though, it's just as simple as we were using this data set. It was Boston Housing data set. It was like from 1972. And one of the columns of data literally was the percentage of black people in that area, which is like just, I mean, we look at it now and we just, you know, I look at it, I was like, oh my gosh, and then do you give that data set and let this kid use it? Do you give the data set, let the kid see it and say, and then have this rich discussion about, do you include it? You know, you don't, right? But you need to be aware of what that is. Do you throw out the whole data set? Do you just not use that feature? Yeah, you can have like the trolley problem, like you were saying, but you can also have really rich discussions just about normal everyday stuff that's happening without having to, I don't want to say how to have to make stuff up, but that would be an example.
There was a woman whose name escapes me that I spoke to from Boston, I think, who teaches critical data science.
Yes.
And it's fascinating that actually sort of like that mix of activism and computer science deliberately in the teaching.
And you're right. And you're making these decisions. And I actually think that is going to be a core piece of what students learn in elementary and middle school. Understanding the data, understanding the decisions that people make with those data, as you do these projects, making those decisions, right? And I actually think that is going to be a core piece. Because these models are just going to do stuff for you, right? And on the front end is where humans are going to be making a lot of the decisions in terms of what data set to use, what features to include, what features not to include. And I actually think that's going to be a critical component on the go forward. And very few people, I mean, it's still in its infancy, right? People aren't really it's not this rigorous discipline yet. And I think it's still kind of the wild, wild west in terms of what to teach and how to teach it.
Let's take the second of your music choices. Let's have The Romantics. What I like about you, what do you like about this?
You know, it's funny because I had this Bach piece at the beginning, which was cerebral, had hard hands and everything else. And how you need to incorporate that into teaching. The Romantics with that song, that's actually in a playlist. So I use whiteboarding a lot in my classroom where I get the kids up at the whiteboard and they solve problems, they write the code for the problems. They all get up at the whiteboard and solve it at the same time. But I'll play music while I'm doing it. And the vibe in the room and The Romantics, that song specifically, is just a good example of like a positive vibe song. And when you teach, that positive vibe goes a long way. Goes a long way to having kids, because coding can be super frustrating. Coding's one of those things where it's like, it doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, and then it finally works. You know, it's like you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, and then you're finally right. So you get all these negative feedback, but if you're in an environment where everybody's working on the same problem, and then you have this music with this positive kind of sound to it, as well as words, it just really helps the students succeed.
Some questions to end the show, and not very much time, so we're going to have to wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think probably one of the biggest successes are my two sons, and getting them out of college, getting them, I'm unbelievably, you know, when you have kids and they're in high school, you worry about where they're going to end up, you worry about the kind of people they're going to be. They're going through all sorts of change and everything, and they are just, they're wonderful to be around. They think about the right stuff. They worry about the right stuff. They're just good people, and they are very, they have a great solid foundation. And I, you know, now that they've been working for like 2 years now, and you know, I think that's, you know, I'm like, okay, I feel pretty comfortable with where they're at. I can kind of move on and do my own thing. So I would say probably, not that I'm the reason for their success, but yeah, that's probably it.
We're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. It's our collection of people doing good work. So you are in that team. What's your superpower?
Wow. I would say two things. I always have to build something, and I kind of see the future a little bit. I can kind of connect the dots for the future. I like being on the cutting edge. And I think from a teaching perspective, I see, when I look at the students, I see the best that they can be. Like, I don't see how they're failing in class or what their issues are, even though I'm aware of it. But I'm like, oh wow, in 10 years, you can be a great person because you're really nice. Or you can be a great person because you analyze problems well. Or you're going to be a great person because you're going to be great in sales. You know, you may not be the best programmer, but you'll be able to. And I can, since I've been around and I've seen enough, I can, and that's what I look for in my students. And in people, and I don't know if I'd call it a superpower, but it's definitely something. Yeah.
The trick is if we can understand those things,
yes,
then we can work out how to teach them.
Right. Exactly. Right. And pull that out. And you know, there'll be some students like, oh, you know, and I've had students where they're like, you know, I'm not the best programmer in the world. I'm like, no. What's going to happen is you're going to go into sales. You're going to go into tech sales, and because you know enough about computing, you're going to be able to add a ton of value because you're going to be a bridge. Or there's going to be somebody who's really good at design and graphics, and they may not be the best programmer. I'm like, do you know how many times I've been in a room where the graphic designer and the programmer hated each other, didn't talk the same language, and they needed a bridge? You know, so you can say, you're going to be that bridge. And then all of a sudden, they see things in a different light. They see the value they can add, even though they may not be, you know, the best programmer.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, not about for whiteboarding and for incorporating CS into as many classrooms as possible. Because I think I believe that the computer is the most powerful tool that humans have right now, and it will be for a while. And I am a full-on activist for getting as many students learning how to use the computer as a tool as I can. And I don't mean using it as like a user like TikTok. I mean using it to solve problems, answer questions.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
You know, you talk to people and some people hate math, some people hate computer science, or I'm not a computer scientist, or I'm not a math person. And sometimes, a lot of times, it's because they had some math teacher or some computer science teacher that demotivated them and convinced them they weren't good at math, convinced them because they weren't good at computer science. I want to be that computer science where the students say, you're the best computer, you're the best teacher I've ever had. You're the best, you know, and I know it doesn't always happen, but that's what motivates me. And I know I'm not the best teacher for everybody, which motivates me to keep improving because there's so much more I need to improve on. But I want them to tell little kids, oh no, you need to take Dr. Chapin because he's the best teacher I've ever had.
What's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
AI, ML, and data science, and trying to figure out how to get it into K-12, not just in the high school, and not just in my high school. I think that's the future, and I'm in a district that I think can support that and wants to support it.
Are the barriers financial and logistic, or is
logistic? Yeah, probably less financial. I think it's more convincing elementary school teachers to incorporate it and spend time to do that, because they're so focused on, which they should be, so focused on the reading and math, that, you know, convincing them that it's important, it might even actually help their reading and math scores.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, I think I've come around to realizing that for people, finding the fit for yourself in life and being comfortable with where you fit is an extremely good thing. And realizing that and trying not to be somebody that you think your parents think you should be or something that society thinks you should be. You know, if you're a caring, compassionate person, you want to be a nurse, that's awesome. You don't need to be a computer science, you know, programmer. If you're a computer science programmer, but appreciate the other people that are, and then surrounding yourself with people that appreciate that in you, that makes any sense, and support that. I think probably one of the biggest ways to be unhappy is It's not to understand what you're good at and what value you add, and then also not surrounding yourself around people that validate the value you add.
Good advice. Multi-tiered good advice.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I think we're going to call the show See the Best Bubbles.
Yes, I love it.
Been listening to Blowing Bubbles. We've been talking with Dr. John Chapin from Leesburg, Virginia. I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Ma te wa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.